This show is a Rochester Podcast Network production. For more information on hosting your own show or advertising, visit rochesterpodcast.com.
Welcome to another episode of Noah Knows. I'm your host, Noah Jobin, and today we have a very special guest on the podcast once again, PhD Dr. Mike Israetel, co-founder of Renaissance Periodization, which is perhaps one of the most prestigious training and diet facilities, arguably, in the country. So, Mike, thank you for coming back on the show. How are we doing today?
Really good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to have someone of your caliber and clout on the show. It means a lot to me to have you on. So thank you very much. I have a list of questions from various sources on social media. Our goal here is to bring a little bit of science to general population. So. Very simple question here. Where did you come up with the name Renaissance Periodization?
That's a good question. So I, myself and Nick Shaw, we had jobs as personal trainers, training folks in New York City, and a lot of them worked in finance. And there was a company there that was a hedge fund, like a financial trading company. And they were started by a former code breaker and mathematician. And instead of doing trading with sort of human experts that would predict which way stocks were going and use sort of the heuristics and kind of rules that were never specified in their heads, what they did was they got a bunch of supercomputers together and hired a bunch of PhDs and ran mathematical models. And that way became maybe the most successful hedge fund of all time.
Really?
Yep. And they were called Renaissance Technologies. And when I heard about them, it was just like, we were super inspired. And also the Renaissance period in history is the one in which, you know, after millennia of the dogma and tradition and faith, science and reason sort of was reborn. And that was sort of the inspiration for our company, was the rebirth of science and reason in fitness. Because when Nick and I were training people in New York, it was all just like, oh, like this coach is good and he trains good athletes. What does he say? And people would collect diets by name. Like, what do you think about this diet, that diet? And there was never an attempt to go back to principles and understand why diets work, why training works, just, you know, dogma here and there. And then that coupled with the fact that Renaissance Technologies was sort of doing that in the stock market was super inspirational to us. And what we do is periodization. So Renaissance Periodization.
Well, I mean, you guys are doing a hell of a job. You and your team have collected some of the highest ranking PhDs and MDs in the field. So kudos to you guys.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Speaking of periodization, I want to get into a comment or a post made by David Mathis recently through Team BioLane. He was one of the other hosts when you came on previously. So, and very, very curious to how you would react to this, because he, in his post, basically he goes on and he talks about like, what is the appropriate training age to introduce someone to, you know, quote unquote, science-based training, you know, the mesocycles, the periodization, macrocycles, advanced training techniques. And from him or his company's standpoint, they said, or it was their opinion that probably should hold off until they have at least 2 years of dedicated lifting experience before introducing them into periodization. Tripping over my words here. And that before that time, it may be much more beneficial for them to stick to very simple training methods. I don't want to necessarily say bro splits, because they don't specifically say that in the post, but they go on to say that simple may be better, you know, just adding a little 5 pounds on the bar, linear progression, maybe a little bit, a little boring type of training, but it may suit their needs better and save, you know, the more advanced stuff for a few years down the road.
What do they have in mind when they say advanced stuff?
It's tough to say in that situation because it's, you know, it's just an Instagram post. It's just a Facebook post. And, you know, the title was something along the lines of, you know, mesopsychos, micropsychos, so on and so forth. Periodization, is it even necessary, right? And it doesn't get super advanced or elaborate in saying, you know, what advanced training is, but they're able to say 2 years less training experience, not necessary to do that.
Mm. I think you have a good point there that training when you're a beginner doesn't need to be complex in order to get good gains. It can be very simple, and that's for sure true. And also, if you're coaching somebody who's a beginner, you know, telling them a bunch of terminology, like, here's what we're doing. This training block, this microcycle, this macrocycle, it's very confusing. Mm-hmm. So you can definitely tell people less about what's going on behind the scenes. And also you should be keeping things very simple and introducing layers of complexity as they are needed for more and more advanced athletes for sure. So that's definitely true. On the other hand, it's difficult to avoid a microcycle because that's the training week. So you have to use microcycle.
Fair point.
Anytime you incorporate an accumulation and deload structure, which is necessary for everyone, you're doing a mesocycle. And progressions will not only occur in weight for almost any training age. They'll occur in sets and occur in technique, and they'll occur in reps sometimes. So, you know, your progressions and have to have a structure that determines them, like 5 pounds more on the bar. That's an interesting notion. And then you ask, okay, like how often? Once a week. Well, there's a microcycle progression. You don't have to tell your clients that.
Right.
That is. So the level of intricacy of periodization has to be less for beginner folks. But also there's some intricacies of periodization that have more intense for beginners. For example, attention to technique, modulation of load away from failure. I'm a big believer that beginners should be going very close to failure because that leads to technical breakdown and leads to poor motor learning. And they should be staying very far away from failure and practicing the lifts with good technique.
Right.
And establishing good technique. And that requires its own attention to detail and its own proper volumes and intensities and weights on the bar. I don't think you should just let beginners do sort of whatever and learn by themselves. I think you should restrain them to doing the right things, but of course, keep it simple. Keep it simple as far as they can tell.
Yeah. Like
you don't have to tell them anything about macrocycle. You just say, this week you're doing this, next week you're doing that.
Right.
You don't even have to tell them next week. You just say, this week you're doing this. And then, okay, they do it. But there has to be an underlying structure and a plan on your end as a coach. And that plan can be, should start out pretty simple. Another reason to start out plan simple is because you never know who's going to last. So if you make like a 4-year plan of progression for someone, they could quit after 2 months. You'd be like, wow, that's stupid.
Yeah.
Right? So you start people simple, but you at the same time are always aware of all the principles behind periodization and know that you're still doing a good job. You don't want to do things willy-nilly.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up a good point there. And I think you probably speak to a lot of the same points that he, David Mathis brought up in his post is that, you know, it's still important to have a plan, right? But you're still controlling what's as a trainer, as a coach, you're still controlling what's going on and guiding them in the right direction. It's not just like, oh, hey, do this and like, you know, send them off into the wild and, you know, see if they survive like a Spartan or something like that, right?
Sure.
You just may not be using the, you know, quote unquote advanced or scientific terminology to keep things simplified so they don't get confused or overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, you might always do that. If you're coaching clients, you might have advanced clients you never use advanced terminology with because it's not their job. You know, it's your job to learn the terminology and use it. And it's their job to execute the plan as written. Now, if they ask what's going on, you can use all the advanced terminology you want.
Right. Going from something like this, where we're looking at a very simplistic approach, I want to go completely to the opposite end of the spectrum here. And I want to touch on a post that you recently made. And it's something that Eric Helms has elaborated as well. And I'm sure you'll remember this post because, you know, in your comment section or where you wrote about the post is, you know, you have constant tension is mostly bullshit. I'm sure you don't mean that, or maybe you do. I don't know. You know, it's very easy to, you know, kind of be cheeky with statements like that. But it's looking at, you know, tempo, right? Where Eric Helms' book on muscle and strength pyramid, he says arguably the least important aspect when it comes to training is tempo, right? And he finishes out that chapter with just lift the weights. And I mean, there's a lot of nuance and minutia that goes into something like that. Take us through that post where, you know, you elaborate on, you know, not needing constant tension through the exercise, that having a little bit of pause in between your reps is going to be more beneficial.
So what's the purpose of constant tension?
I would say if someone is looking at that, they think that having that constant load, increasing the intensity, probably trying to increase hypertrophy or the amount of damage that that they're doing to the muscle to rebuild stronger.
So if you like, let's take a leg press, for example. You do leg press with constant tension only, so you never lock out. Mm-hmm. You never pause at the bottom. You might be able to get, like, let's say using 400 pounds, you might be able to get 10 reps, and then you're, you know, one shy of failure, and you have to rack the weight and stop. Okay, it's good. It's very good. 10 reps, close to fail, good hypertrophy stimulus. On the other hand, if you lock out every repetition, and just for a super brief second, and then maybe stop at the bottom for a super brief second, you might be able to get like 12 or 13 reps. And what is especially interesting is more of those reps could be closer to failure and relying on recruiting most of your motor units. So you get actually more effective reps, so to speak, that way. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear which one of those sets is more hypertrophy inducing than the other. And I don't think the first one's any more hypertrophy inducing because the actual total volume of the set is lower. The number of reps close to failure is lower. And if we do a real expanded look, really push the rest breaks, we could do, you know, sort of constant-ish tension for the first 8 reps and rest for 2 or 3 seconds. Another 4 reps, rest for 2 or 3 seconds. And then we could get like 20 reps in a set like that. The number of those reps that are close to failure is like 12. Whereas if we just did 10 reps and stopped, the number of reps close to failure is like 4. It's probably much more hypertrophy stimulus, much more volume, much more total metabolite accumulation. You get a much bigger pump like that after a set, much more burn, much more tension imposed on the muscles. Remember, constant tension says nothing about total tension. Like if you stop between every rep for a second and you do 10 reps, you get 10 reps of total tension. If you do constant tension, you get 10 reps of total tension. So the only real big fear with, there's sort of two fears with not doing constant tension. One is, you take such a big break between each repetition, the metabolites have a chance to dissipate, and you never sum metabolites, and that never allows the metabolite pathways to go, and or you never get a big enough pump. It's a very, very big concern. So it's up to the lifter to decide if they're taking rest breaks that are so long that they're not getting good pump from training. Definitely don't want to do that, right? And the other one is that you're taking such big breaks between your reps that you're not approaching failure closely, and then you're stopping at the end of the weight or at the end of the set, and you haven't even gone close to failure because you took too many rest breaks, and you're always sort of good to go for another 2 or 3 reps, and then you get 10 and you stop. Well, that's a very easy problem to fix. You just do more reps until you get close to failure, and you get more reps per set. So, you know, in my experience with many exercises, constant tension is not remotely required to get the gnarly, gnarly pump. And in fact, in many exercises like skull crushers, leg presses, hack squats, if you take mini rest breaks here and there during the set, like 1 or 2 second breaths, you can actually get so many reps and get so close to failure that you get even gnarlier pump and even more metabolite sequestration than if you do straight set and just have to stop right? So a cool way to combine the two is to do constant tension or close to constant tension for, you know, like, you know, 5 to 8 reps or something, mm-hmm. and you get close to failure, you stop, lock out, go again, right. 4 reps or something, and repeat. That sort of is the best of both worlds. But, you know, those are very easy sort of concerns to brush aside and make, at the very least, not concerns. And at the very most, actually taking some strategic pauses in your set could make the set more hypertrophic, albeit more fatiguing. So, you know, it's basically like constant tension is totally fine, but it doesn't seem to offer any really big advantages that you can't do with short pauses. I mean, nobody's saying take 4-second rests between sets, although that research has been done on rest pause training. And on average, the rest pause training is as hypertrophic or sometimes even more than normal training. So people will wave around the, you know, there's like one study that sort of implies constant tension is a little better, but there's numerous studies that imply rest pause is at least as good and maybe better. So it's difficult to argue that constant tension does anything. And then constant tension definitely has some downsides as well. For example, on a lat pull down, if you're doing constant tension, you may get into some reps in which the groove kind of sucked, but you can never stop for a second and re-examine, reposition your shoulders, reposition your back, because you're like, I gotta keep going, right? And if you have if you don't worry about constant tension so much, but worry about, you know, getting to the reps, not taking huge breaks, but every now and again, if you need to reset between the rep, like as just get to the top and go, okay, and then I'm pulling with my shoulders, so on and so forth, then you actually may improve the quality of your average repetition because you're not so pressured to just keep going all the time.
Yeah, no, yes, I would agree with that. You know, it's one of those, especially if you have a beginner going into the situation where they, you know, it's something that I've dealt with on a regular basis with brand new clients that are like, okay, well, how long should the concentric be? How long should the eccentric be? Should I be pausing? Should I not be pausing? Just constant tension, right? And these are brand new people. And it's, I think in that situation, you're stepping over dollars to pick up cents, right? There's far more important applications to focus on than just, you know, the tempo of an exercise. And especially in that sort of situation where it's much more of an advanced training application that for someone who's new, who may not necessarily have that proper mind-muscle connection, like you pointed out, they're just going because they're worried about the mm-hmm. constant tension, right? Are they building up bad habits? Are they losing the ability to focus on exactly how to pull, how to push, how that muscle should be contracting and feeling during those exercises?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, when I'm coaching beginners, I stay away from constant tension entirely on purpose. Every repetition is treated as its own. And one thing I do if I'm coaching them in real life, which I don't do a whole lot of, but I used to do a lot of, is I will only count repetitions out loud that I like, that are full range of motion, under control, and angled properly like they're supposed to be. So if you're not taking your leg presses deep enough, or you're not taking your rows deep enough, or you're not touching your tummy on rows when you're supposed to be, I'll say 4, 4, that's still 4, touch your tummy, and they're right. Like, fuck. But if it's constant tension, right, then it's like, I don't know, like that's 3 reps, I guess, we just sort of reps. And they're so worried about keeping going, but they're not like, they can't take a break at the bottom of the row and be like, okay, touch my tummy this time. And then they do it, right? Also giving people cues and giving yourself cues when you're advanced enough, really tough when constant tension is the goal. Giving yourself cues, if you have a chance to break for even a fifth of a second between sets, makes a difference because you can sort of reset a little bit and be like, okay, this time I'm going to reach all the way down, mm-hmm. right? Stuff like that. So I think more advanced athletes, when they have really good technique, really good mind-muscle connection, can strategically use constant tension to get in clusters of reps and then rest, clusters of reps and then rest. That's totally fine. But even if you never do that and you just do your reps, you know, 1, rest, 2, rest, mm-hmm. 3, rest, anyone's going to tell me that grows less muscle than doing them constant tension has a huge theoretical hill to climb and a massive empirical hill to climb. Yeah. Hills haven't been climbed. I'd be honest, I don't see how the theoretical hill is to be climbed. You know, the metabolite summation one is the most convincing one, but that one is really quickly obviated by just saying, hey, after you rest a little bit, keep going. You know, I've never seen someone do a set of 20 in the leg press with mini rest pauses and be like, man, that sucked. They didn't get a pump. Yeah, I fucking mind. Barely get off the machine at that point. Now I have. done constant tension leg press reps, where because it's constant tension, I get close to failure real quick and I have to rack because I'm not doing any more reps. And I'm like, that really wasn't that hard of a set. Like, leg press failure sneaks up on you so fast that the number of reps you get that are circa failure, right? It's just not that many. And then you're kind of like, I'm going to have to do like 8 sets of this to feel anything. But if you do rest pause sets, 3 sets later, you can't walk and you're throwing up blood and you're like, well, I guess that was good enough. So are there some exercises in which constant tension may be a little bit of a net benefit from the metabolite perspective? Yeah, like, you know, like maybe cable curls or something like that. Like, you don't want to lock out fully and stuff because you might like have to do more reps to get the same pump. I'm not entirely convinced by that. I'm very open-minded to that idea. But at the same time, you're reducing the total amount of tension and repetitions you get per set. And you're also potentially missing out on the stretch component. Remember, stretch under tension, stretch under load is an independent component of hypertrophy. It's a big deal. And if you're saying, hey, constant tension is going to be good because, you know, it has the metabolite summation effect, which is, you know, pretty vetted in research as hypertrophic, but then you're trading it off from like a full range of motion, which can also be hypertrophic. Yeah, you know, I'm not so convinced by that. And I think just doing more reps and resting a little and doing more reps and resting a little gets you the best of all worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that, you know, I think for myself, I work in both public and private capacity where I'll see guys, you know, just, you know, maybe they're just going super high volume or they're trying to hit metabolite, but it seems like it's the constant tension thing, but their range of motion is so limited, right? Like someone with like rope cable curls that's only getting like half of it and they're just hammering away,
yeah,
right?
Doing
like
something all right.
Like what is there's just overwhelming data that looks at range of motion, right? Probably the most significant studies are the ones that look into squat depth range, right? Where it's, you know, 60% versus 90% versus 130, right? And although we see continued growth for all ranges of motion, I mean, the most significant in terms of muscle cross fiber strength and growth, right? Yeah. Always comes from the deepest range of motion.
I will have to say it's something that RP Plus member and the good friend of ours, Daniel Jolly, pointed out is kind of like a real talk point. Is like, let's be honest, you know, most of the people, many of the people saying constant tension is really just a justification for using a reduced range of motion, using more load. Like, you say constant tension because you're too big of a wuss to pick up the 70s. You want to pick up the 110 dumbbells. And with the 70s, with a pause at the top of the chest and a lockout at the top, you wouldn't look so tough, but you would get the same hypertrophy with less, you know, joint fatigue and less having to use a ton of weight, less RPE. And then in addition, I'll say, you know, bodybuilders like to pat themselves on the back for being tough and hardcore, but like constant tension, you know, cable curls, you know, usually you say a constant tension is because it's hard. Like, yeah, it's tough. Constant tension is tough. And okay, try it with going full range of motion and stopping between each rep for a split second.
Oh yeah.
And then you take them through a set to failure that way. And they're like, holy shit, that was so fucking hard. And you're like, yeah, maybe you're running away from what's hard. And constant tension, because remember, constant tension leads to failure faster. It might actually be easier. And it's sort of good that it leads to failure faster in some respects, but it's also bad because you don't get to hang around failure much. And hanging around that close to failure point and grinding in those reps might make those reps a bit more hypertrophic. So it's one of those things that at best, it's just by no means clear to me why constant tension would be always preferred. And at worst, it may actually be on the net balance a slightly less than advantageous strategy in many, if not most cases. And my biggest problem with constant tension is my biggest problem with a lot of things is people will say, well, this is the way to train. You ask them why, and they have no fucking idea at all. They're like, constant tension, right? And you're like, why? And they're like, well, because, you know, exposing the muscle to tension. And you're like, you're doing that anyway if you're adding up a bunch of reps. It's like seeing how many letters you can write without taking your pen off the paper. And it'd be like, well, so what's wrong with taking your pen off the paper and putting it back down? They're like, well, there's no answer to that, right?
Yeah, no, I absolutely hit the nail on the head. And I think a perfect example from your own personal experience is when you do your lat raises. I mean, like, you are massive and you're strong. You are probably one of the most intimidating PhDs I've ever met in my life, you know? But I mean, like, you yourself, like, you just recently hit PRs on lat raises with the pause. And I mean, like, you can go to any gym and see someone using like a 60 or a 70 or 80 pound dumbbell and they're getting the massive swing and stuff in there. And it's
somebody could say that I'm still using constant tension, right? Because the pauses at the top when my muscles are tensed. But then, you know, somebody could say, okay, so a guy who does like 10 lat raises strict and then lets his arms hang by his sides for like 2 seconds and then does more. Are you saying that guy's doing a worse set than someone who just stops? Like, really? You know, like just doing more reps and getting close to failure? I think a lot of people, like, so here's another interesting thing, like in myo reps, you know what those are? Or like rest pause reps when you like do a bunch of, like do a set of like 15 and then wait like 10 or 20 seconds, then do another set of five.
Just
or six.
Enough for like the lactate to dissipate,
right,
and
to
then go.
Clear, and then you get another high quality set in. Like that's the opposite of constant tension, but people think that's great too. It's just not really clear what people think a lot of times. And I honestly think people just say stuff, man. And this is something my friend and coworker Jared Feather would say, is people just
Monster.
Say stuff to sound like they, yeah, super freak. People say stuff to sound like they know shit. Oh, constant tension. This is something people say, like, oh, like, you know, like, I'm sure you've been through this. So people will ask you like diet, like, oh, do you do macros? You do macros, right? Like, what the fuck is macros? Like, do you count your macros or do you only look at macros? Like, people just like to say stuff sometimes. And I unfortunately, I think, you know, many people have thought this through and constant tension does have merits, but some people just say things like constant tension because, you know, it sounds hardcore. Like constant sounds better than intermittent, you know, like always tension is so tough. Is it really though? I don't know.
I mean, I think it's like anything else when we look at, you know, the scientific principles or how we equate what is important or not important, right? We can say that, or, you know, by Eric Helms, you know, like he has, you know, his list of 1 through 8, and, you know, he ranks everything in order of magnitudes, what's most significant, what is least significant, right? And it's important to note that these are comparative, right? Like, just because something is the least important principle of training still doesn't mean that it's not important, right? That it doesn't have value. It's like anything else. It's time and place. And it's, you know, like with your book, The Scientific Principles of Strength Training, like specificity trumps everything, right? Like if your goal is to accomplish something that needs constant tension, right? That's what you do. Okay. Whatever that may be. But if it's not, like, it shouldn't be a priority.
Sure. And to Eric's point, when he said that, you know, tempo is the least important of all the variables, Brad Schoenfeld has done a review of literature on tempo where he's illustrated pretty well. And, you know, there's not a ton of studies on this, but there's enough to get a good inroad. Mm-hmm. It's like anything, you know, short of 9 seconds of total repetition, like something like 3 second concentric, 3 second pause, 3 second eccentric, something like that. 9 seconds total for repetition. Anything shorter than that is probably roughly equal to 1 second, 2 second, 3 seconds, etc. If you start using reps that are longer than 9 seconds in duration, it has been shown that that leads to less hypertrophy. But usually, when you do a set of like at least 5 reps, which most people do for hypertrophy, taking 9 total seconds per rep is now you're into, by definition, in order to last 5 repetitions of that, you have to use a load that starts to border on that 30% of 1RM range, mm-hmm. below which we know that hypertrophy probably drops off in most instances. So it's, again, not even a factor of it may not be directly a factor, mm-hmm. of how slow each rep is. It's the fact that the weight you have to use is now so light.
Right.
That's the problem, right? So I think if you used like your 10 RM and did one rep that took 10 seconds, that could be as hypertrophic as doing 5 or 6 reps. You know, we don't know that, right? But that kind of study's never been carried out because it's a fucking weird way to train. So in the studies in which they do use very, very slow reps, usually they have to concomitantly lighten the weight, and it may be the weight lightening that's doing the thing. But for all intents and purposes, I mean, almost nobody, unless you're doing like super slow training on purpose, if people ask you about tempo, my best advice is control the eccentric. Sometimes you can take a pause, you don't have to, and then make a forceful but controlled concentric. Right. And that's the best advice you could give, I think, because everything should be under control and the concentric should be forceful, like oomph, put some oomph into it. Don't needlessly slow your concentric. That's pretty good advice. And your eccentric, if you want to make it 1 second eccentric, still control, totally cool. If you want to make it even up to a 4 or 5 second eccentric under control, that's totally fine, right? As long as your total rep, concentric, eccentric, and the change of direction isometric, if as long as that doesn't exceed 9 seconds, another way to put it, as long as the weight you're using to justify your slow eccentrics isn't so light that it's not even challenging anymore, like it's below 30% of your owner max, you're good to go. And a lot of times people will really dig into like, okay, cadence, like what's the golden ticket with cadence? What is the exact eccentric speed? What about slow eccentrics and negatives and all that stuff? And they're really asking questions that probably just make very little difference. And another sort of point of recommendation is I would use it as a tool of variation, like one mesocycle or one training block, you do squats normally. In another training block, you know, 3 mesocycles in a row, roughly, you can do slower eccentric squats. And that lets you take a little bit of weight off the bar, maybe lets you focus on taking a little better, a little more on the mind-muscle connection. Mm-hmm. And that's totally cool. It's just another good way to train. It's like people, and this is a huge point in general. I get this question a lot. A lot of fitness professionals get this question of like, so what's better, like assisted pull-ups or lat pull-downs? Or what's the best grip for lat pull-downs? There is no answer to that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah.
like asking like, what's better, mashed potatoes, rice, or pasta? It's like, there's no answer to that.
Yeah.
But the answer is, you know, when you get tired of eating mashed potatoes, you should eat some rice. And when you get tired of eating that, you should eat some pasta. Same idea with the grips for lat pull-downs, pull-ups, and cadence largely goes into that as well.
Yeah, it's like how you've talked previously about exercise selection, right? Like there are some moves that if you are continuing to make progress, keep them in. Like it could be a full year of doing the same exercise. If you're continuing to make progress, there's no reason to get rid of it. However, if you're getting into a situation where you just never feel the pump or it just doesn't feel good, right? Or you're not making progress anymore, like that's probably
or your joints hurt or something.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I want to move on and I want to ask you about a somewhat recently published study. I know James Krieger just recently made the study free. It was behind the paywall and I wanted very limited research on this, but I just wanted to pick your brain on it. And so that was his case study that he did with the weighted vest and the artificial load. Are you familiar with the results of that, where for every pound lost, they added in an additional pound? And, you know, I forget what the athlete's name was, but he went on a monster tear, right? Like won his pro card, went national, became started winning at a pro level, national level, all that stuff like that. Did no cardio, you know, said it was the best prep of his life, easiest prep of his life. But the part I want to get into that is the most interesting, which I'd like to see more research in, is the fact that it suggests for the first time ever that bone cells may play a role in dictating how hungry we are, right? He alluded to the fact that this may be the reason why people who are living sedentary lifestyles, because they're sitting all the time, that their bone cells don't have the opportunity to sense the force of gravity when standing or moving, and therefore the body thinks that it's lighter than it actually is, inducing hunger on a more frequent basis. Whereas someone who is of an active lifestyle, their bones sense the overall weight of said person more, which will decrease appetite. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that hypothesis. I mean, it's potentially true, but it needs a lot more research vetting to see if it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's the first study of its kind. So I'm not surprised by that. So
sure. And I don't think there was any mechanistic evidence for that I've seen, but there could be. So it's an interesting hypothesis, but I don't think there's any direct data support quite yet.
Yeah.
Certainly not enough. I will say that the weighted vest is a really cool idea, just from not even a hunger perspective, but an energy expenditure perspective. You're just going to burn a lot more energy doing everything you usually do. My only thing is, you know, it's going to be an intersection with the real world that's difficult in many cases. It was like, do you lift with that thing on? Maybe you can't put your belt over it. Your bent rows hit the vest instead of your body. So sort of strange. Can you do cardio with it? Totally. That's super easy. Can you do chores with it? Yeah. Can you go to your job with it, put on your suit and tie and put on a vest? No. If you sit around for work, does sitting with a vest help? Maybe a little bit, probably not much. It's probably the moving with it that helps more. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those, like, if the practical barriers aren't too great and you can practically integrate it into your lifestyle and plan, then it's for sure going to work really, really well. But it has some impediments.
Yeah. It's, there's a couple, you pointed out a few caveats, drawbacks to wearing something like that. I'm also curious, because you have to wear it indefinitely, right? Like, as soon as you stop wearing it, you don't get the results of it anymore. But based off of what it did for said person in the deficit, right? I'm curious if you believe or think or could hypothesize that there's an application for weighted vests in reverse dieting, if perhaps
it... Yeah, totally. Fantastic. Same thing.
Yeah.
Same one. Yeah. Cool. And then when you're back at your normal weight and your hunger isn't crazy, you can take the vest off.
Yep.
And then put it back on when you start dieting again. Mm-hmm.
Badass. I love it. Simple. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to get into just various questions I got on social media since making the post. And first question is, do you have any plans to compete in bodybuilding again?
Yes.
Ooh. All right.
So my bodybuilding competition history has been sort of fraught with disaster, mini disaster. I get sick a lot before shows, and I, for a long time, had no idea how to peak, possibly still don't.
Really?
Yeah. And then I don't know, I've never been super duper lean, and when I have been, I've been sort of covered with a coat of water so that I couldn't actually see how lean I was. But I'm learning more and more how not to do those things. And this, doing a cut right now, I just started like 5 weeks ago, and I'm going to try to do it for the next 15. And probably get, the goal is to get as lean as ever and the super, super, super lean, and to where I don't have to question whether or not I'll be competitive in bodybuilding. And then when I'm that lean, I'll register for a show and do a show.
Fantastic. I love it. Any chances that, Chad Wesley may try to bring you to, the powerlifting side?
It's really funny. People ask me that. I powerlifted before social media existed.
Really?
Yeah, I started as a powerlifter.
Okay.
Very few people know that again. It's just really funny that people are like, you ever want to try powerlifting? I've tried it. I've done it. I finished it. I'll never do it again.
No shit. Wow, that's cool, yeah, man. What's, for sure. Comparatively speaking, did you put up numbers like Chad Wesley or did
you? No, God, no. Oh, my God. Like maybe literally half of his numbers. So I was 220 pounder for much of my powerlifting career. I squatted, it sort of depends on, like, so no knee reps. My best squat was 490. My best bench was 385. And my best deadlift was 567.
Wow.
In competition. I did more than that in training because I didn't know how to peak.
Right.
So when I trained for powerlifting, I knew very, very little. And I made tons of mistakes. And I'm way better powerlifting coach now than I was for myself, because I was a generation ago, basically.
Yeah, so. I mean, yeah, your time with Chad Wesley and the research. I mean, not to mention just if you know, you say you did this before the advent of social media, I have to imagine the amount of just muscle mass and the capability of mechanical tissue recruitment that you have is going to be astronomically higher.
Well, I'll put you this way. So I low bar squatted 490 in competition at a 220 weight class. And then in the same basic weight class, just a water cut away from that, several years after, I squatted a high bar 500 for 10, which is on YouTube. So like, you know, yes, back when I was in my early 20s, that's how strong I was.
Damn, man.
Now I'm a lot stronger, but I won't ever compete in powerlifting for one very good reason. The injury risk is too high.
Right.
The other reason is there's no point for me to do it, mm-hmm. Because it wouldn't be a good business move for me. This strength is not my huge gift. It's not my best gift. So, I'd be competitive at the national level or whatever, but no, I would never win anything major. So there's that.
And you've already won my heart, Mike. It's okay.
Yeah, right. I've also accumulated a host of injuries that preclude me from ever really going super heavy in anything other than the squat. And I'm uninterested in going heavy in the squat because it's annoying and really difficult and sums up a lot of fatigue, would greatly interfere with my bodybuilding plans. And I already do two sports. I do jiu-jitsu, and it would greatly interfere with that too.
Right, and
just be kind of, you know, sort of pointless.
All right. So moving on to the next question here. All right. So someone has asked, should I still progress with my weights even while cutting?
So the reason you progress with your weights is to make sure your RPE is on track. Generally speaking, when you start, we can do a very simplified version is you want an average RPE of around two,
Yeah.
An average number of reps in reserve is two for the mesocycle. So average of two reps away from failure. Mm-hmm. My neighbor's slamming the door. Sorry.
That's okay.
I have such a, I have like the best podcasting mic ever or something. A sound guy gave it to me and it like picks up everything.
That's okay.
So that's the simple way to do it. It's just to hit roughly an RIR of two every microcycle for the whole meso. The more advanced ways to have an average of two, but start around three or four reps in reserve and go all the way to one or zero reps in reserve, right? Mm-hmm. So let's just say we're doing that, where we're starting at three reps in reserve and going all the way to zero reps in reserve through the weeks. That means every week of our accumulation phase in a mesocycle, in a cutting phase, we have an RIR target. Like, you know, today, this week, I'm going to hit everything roughly two reps in reserve, and the next week, one rep, and then after that, I'm going to go to failure. So generally speaking, because you want to stay in the same rep range that you planned for your lift, and it's really easy to track progression, you probably want to like roughly or exactly match the repetitions you got from last week while decreasing RIR, maintaining it, right? So mm-hmm. last week I got 300 pounds for a set of 10 and three RIR. This week I need basically another set of 10. I don't want to do 11 reps because, you know, then, you know, I can, but, you know, at some point, if you let the reps float up, then they float out of the, you know, 5 to 15 rep range. And then you sort of like, should I increase weight? So on and so forth. So the reason we increase weight is to keep our RIR on track, which is to say, okay, last week I did 300 for a set of 10, RIR of 3. This week I have to do an RIR of 2. How much weight is it going to take me to do roughly 10 reps RIR 2? Well, that's pretty easy, like 310 or 305, basically, right? So when you're mass gaining, it might take another 10 pounds to get you to an RIR of 2 at 300, because otherwise you just do more reps. But when you're cutting, it might take only 5 pounds because you accumulate more fatigue and your adaptation doesn't occur as quickly, or maybe even 2.5 pounds. Or you may not put any weight on the bar and maybe do the same rep or see if you get one more rep. And then, I got one more rep, okay, RIR 2. Next week, I'll go to 305. So maybe every other week you put 5 pounds on the bar, something like that. So the answer to the question of do I progress in load? The answer to that is, what is the purpose of progressing load? Is to stay on track with your reps in reserve. And on a cut, you have to progress less in load, but you probably still have to progress in load. Deep balls deep into the end of a cut, you may not be progressing in load at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And you may just be maintaining repetitions or trying as best as you can to maintain reps as your RIR falls. There is a little bit of an argument that as you get closer and closer to the end of the cut, the catabolic signaling tends to convert your fiber types a little bit more into slow twitch behavior versus fast twitch behavior. And your muscle fibers may actually be better at repetitions at that point. Also, you're less fat, which helps. Better repetitions and not as good as at limit loads. So maybe at that point, adding more repetitions versus adding weight is a little bit of an advantage. Very, very hypothetical. Just takes a little bit of reasoning to give some thought to. In some situations, it could be a good idea. So at that point, maybe in your last mesocycle cycle, you no longer add weight to the bar, but you add reps. You start with sets of 15 and you slowly try into sets of 17 or 18 on average, right? And that could also keep you a little bit safer because towards the end of a cut, maybe your risk is a little bit higher because you're so high in cumulative fatigue. Maybe adding load is like, I don't want to expose myself to high forces. Adding repetitions may make a little bit more sense. But that's all, you know, the person could have just asked the same question of, well, do I keep progressing in reps during the cut? Basically, you progress as needed to hit your RIR. But because fatigue will be higher and accumulate faster, your progressions won't be as large. But they still will almost certainly happen up until your very last cutting mesocycle, in which case they might be rather constant.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Thank you. We are running out of time here. So I'm going to ask you one more question. this person says that they struggle with getting 6 hours of sleep a night. How can I improve my sleeping habits?
Well, I suppose it's not a scheduling issue. It's they can't fall asleep kind of issue.
It was on Instagram. So, you know, you only have okay. so many variables sure. to put in. So it's
okay. Who knows, man? Well, so, I'll give a couple general tips. Hopefully right. Some of these will help that person. One is to make sure to schedule the right amount of sleep. Mm-hmm. You can schedule your day in such a way that you only have 6 hours to sleep. And then there's no way to get any more sleep because you schedule yourself right out of it. You know, people will say like, oh, like I stay up late to hang out with my kids and then I wake up and go train early at 5 a.m. Well, you know, something's got to give there. So give yourself room to sleep 8 or 9 hours potentially. Another one is something called sleep hygiene. It's a fucking weird term because it's nothing to do with hygiene whatsoever. But one of them is to not expose yourself to stressful or emotional events close to sleep. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you like argue on Instagram with people, you can get really passionate about stuff or share political memes and get yelled at by socialists or like right wingers. And then, you know, that tends to amp you up, and then you're trying to fall asleep and you're like those assholes, you know? So maybe like limit activities like that, do more relaxing things before you go to sleep. Another one is don't eat a whole lot of food before you go to sleep, because sometimes that energy from the food could just keep you awake.
Right.
And the digestion can raise your body temperature and you get hot and then you can't fall asleep. Another one is to keep your room cold and keep good blankets, because humans tend to fall asleep more easily when the outside environment is cold and they feel cozy. So that's another good one. Make sure your bedding is very comfortable. Make sure your room is dark. And sometimes you can experiment with supplements like melatonin, seem to work pretty well. So those are, and a lot of times it's like building a habit of going to sleep at about the same time every night. Mm-hmm. Another big tip with a lot of folks is don't sleep in. If you sleep in, then you bought yourself a bunch of energy that you're going to have to piss away through the day. And then you're just not going to be tired when you go to bed. And my last point is make your days very difficult, both physically and mentally. I read a very good book called How to Stop Worrying and Start Living by Dale Carnegie. I was 17. It changed my life. It's hugely recommended. It's like hilariously outdated in its language. They don't say scientists, they say research men. Like that's how like baller research 1950s men. It is. It's
like Mad Men era.
Literally like the same era. And, but like one thing he says is, you know, I have, folks coming to me because they have insomnia and they can't sleep and they're worried about insomnia, which is like a hilarious like positive feedback loop. And he said, you know, who never has trouble sleeping is people that work a shitload because they're so tired they just go to sleep. So a lot of times, you know, train harder, do a physical job, get your chores done, check every box, and then at the end of the day, you're going to fall asleep like it was supposed to happen. You know, my wife's a doctor and she's in her last year of residency. She can fall asleep at the drop of a hat and sleep for 10 hours, no problem. She doesn't get a chance to do that a lot, but she sure as hell doesn't have sleeping problems. A lot of people who have problems sleeping, you know, they don't do a whole lot through the day, or they really take it easy on themselves. Make it hard on yourself, and then towards the end of the day, take it really easy, relax, have a good meal, probably pretty high in protein, you know, hour or two before you go to bed, really chill out, watch some pleasant TV, read a book. You know, don't do that all the way up until you sleep, you know, 20 minutes before something, relax, take a warm shower, and then make sure your room is cold, nice and dark, get comfy, and don't put a pressure. Here's my last tip. Apparently I know a whole lot about this. If you want to know more about this, my book co-authored with, I'm the second author, Dr. James Hoffman, Recovering from Training, has a whole section on how to improve sleep because sleep is such a huge element of recovery. It's the most important element.
Yeah, absolutely.
My last point there is don't put a pressure on yourself to sleep. People say like, hey, try falling asleep. That's literally impossible if you think about it. How the fuck are you supposed to do that? Like,
dude, it's like the equivalent of telling someone who's overweight to just, oh, hey, man, eat less and be more active. Like, yes, right, the advice is true, but it's like, fuck, I've never thought of that before. Like, thank you.
Like, I need more actionable shit. Yeah. And in falling asleep at that moment when you're in bed and you're laying down, you actually need less actionable shit because the whole point's that action. So after you've done all your good sleep hygiene stuff and you lay down in bed, and this helps me a lot, you are, for the next 8 hours, a completely free person. You have nothing to do. So don't worry about anything. Just let your mind wander. Think about whatever the hell you want. No pressure. You don't have to fall asleep. As soon as you realize you don't have to fall asleep, your ass will be out. You'll be wake up and like, oh shit, it's 6 a.m. Right? Whereas if you're like, oh, I'm really trying to fall asleep. Like, what does that even mean? How is it possible to try to fall asleep? I have no idea. If you're tired and you just relax and let your mind wander, it's going to wander right into a dream almost every single time.
I dig it, man. I dig it. All right. So, Mike, let the people know where they can find you.
Cool. So at RP Strength on Instagram is Renaissance Periodization. Thanks for repping the shirt, by the way.
Oh, yeah, dude. Shirt. Love it.
I didn't even rep RP
Strength. It's okay.
at RP Strength on Instagram is where you can find us. The Renaissance Periodization website is linkable from there. That's where you can buy all sorts of good stuff and read stuff for free. If you type in Hypertrophy Hub, Hypertrophy Guide Central Hub, you get all of my articles, mega articles that I wrote with James Hoffman and Jared Feather about every single muscle group guide of how to train it. Those are being currently updated. We're halfway through the updates. So, I mean, those are about as thorough as you can get. And it's like 15 pages each article, and there's 14 of them, and it's all free. And it's how to design a program for each single muscle group you train. So that's cool. I think your audience might like that. At RP Dr. Mike on Instagram is where I am. And, you know, my page is fine. It's fine page. Half naked pictures of me and stuff like that. And then, lastly, YouTube, RP's YouTube is going to be kicking it more and more. We're going to have more content. So Renaissance Periodization on YouTube is a really good channel to follow. And also Juggernaut Training Systems, the Chad Wesley Smith channel. Chad and I just recorded a whole bunch of videos.
Yeah, I've seen
that. You know, 5 to 7 minute sort of tips for hypertrophy and programming. And people seem to really like those.
Yeah.
And there's like 10 more of those on the way. So if you follow Juggernaut Training Systems on YouTube and follow them on Instagram as well, you can get a lot of really good stuff.
When can we expect the new book, The Scientific Principles of Hypertrophy?
Yeah, so it's currently in editing. One chapter has been edited. The editing is done by Dr. Melissa Davis from RP. It's super, super in-depth editing. So it's going to take months. So I think it's something that's going to come in the summer or fall.
Okay.
We always said 2020 was going to be the release, and everyone always says, hey, when in 2020? I was like, right. Well, the reason I said 2020 is I don't know when.
Yeah.
We are really uninterested in RP. We've seen other folks do this, and we've fibbed a couple times this way before. When we set a release date and there's no way to get it done on time. At RP, our only job, our only mission is quality. When we have a quality book to put out, you know, people like, mostly comically razz me on Instagram and say, when's the book? Release it now. Like, you want a nasty rough draft that makes no damn sense with no references? Sweet. I'll send it over. And then you'll have more questions than answers, right? So probably this summer or fall, the book's going to really the writing, the main writing is completely done. All the figures are made. It just has to be synthesized into a very good readable product. And editing takes a long time if you want a good book. So it's in editing. It's all good stuff. But it'll be worth the wait when it comes out.
It's gonna be super awesome. I highly believe that because I've read most of your books already, and they are overwhelming in quality and quantity. So
thank you so much,
Mike. Thank you so much for being here. Guys watching, listening, thank you so much. Please remember to like, favorite, share, subscribe, and we'll see you on the next one.